look at our top stories this hour. Iran's UN ambassador says Tehran will return to full implementation of the 2015 deal if other parties to the accord, quote, keep their end of the bargain. Turkey says three ships carrying grain will leave Ukraine's ports on Friday under a recent UN-backed deal between Moscow and Kiev. Also ahead, four U.S. police officers face federal charges of civil rights offenses over their role in the killing of a young black woman during a raid. Hello and welcome. Your world news come to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Iran's UN ambassador says Tehran will return to full implementation of the 2015 deal if other parties to the accord keep their end of the bargain. Majid Takhravanchi made the remarks in response to accusations leveled against the country by the U.S. and its European allies, the U.K., France, and Germany. Iran's ambassador said the U.S. and its allies have no moral ground to address the country's peaceful nuclear program, as they have been actively strengthening their own nuclear arsenals. Takhravanchi said they have also turned a blind eye to Israel's military nuclear program while extending their unjustified support for the regime. He noted that the countries accusing Iran have also consistently failed to comply with their obligations under the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA, since the U.S. quit the deal in May 2018. After the U.S.'s withdrawal, the remaining parties to the deal have held several rounds of talks to revive the deal. The talks failed due to the U.S. failure to show goodwill and its excessive demands. A new round of talks has just started in the Austrian capital, with Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagheri Kani calling on the U.S. to seize the latest opportunity. Iran's deputy foreign minister and top negotiator has held talks in Vienna as part of negotiations to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ali Bagheri Kani held talks with European Union's coordinator Enrique Mora. Prior to that, he met with Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov. The top Iranian negotiator is leading a delegation who arrived in the Austrian capital earlier on Thursday to resume talks to restore the pact. The JCPOA was derailed after Washington withdrew unilaterally from it in 2018. The remaining parties have held several rounds of talks since April last year. But the negotiations came to a halt in March due to what Iran calls the U.S. failure to show goodwill, as well as its excessive demands. Iran's president says supporting Palestine and the regional resistance remains the definite policy of the Islamic Republic. Ebrahim Raisi was speaking in a meeting with Secretary General of the Gaza-based Islamic Jihad movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, in Tehran. He said Iran believes resistance will emerge victorious and al-Quds will be liberated from the Israeli occupation. Raisi said the support of nations for Palestine is the biggest obstacle to the implementation of policies of the U.S. and Israel in West Asia. Ziad al-Nakhala, for his part, hailed Iran's support for regional resistance groups. He said Iran plays a major role in standing up against the hegemonic powers. Israel has closed its crossings with Gaza, further tightening its inhumane blockade of the territory that has been in place since 2007. According to analysts, the ongoing closure of the crossings will further decrease the already low standards of living in this tiny seaside territory. Panashev Shannon has more details in this report.
The Israeli regime has sealed its crossings with the Gaza Strip since Tuesday, further exacerbating the humanitarian situation in the impoverished territory. Currently, there are two Israeli-controlled crossings into the tiny coastal territory, the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, and the Erez pedestrian crossing in northern Gaza. The crossings have been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007.
The Israel closure of the crossings for the third day has serious, severe implications on the lives of the Palestinians in Gaza Strip. We are calling on the international community for immediate actions to pressure Israel to lift the blockade in Gaza.
The impoverished coastal territory already suffers from high poverty and unemployment rates. Most Gazans also depend on handouts from international aid agencies to survive.
Closing the crossing point from the Israeli occupation, it's A collective punishment, it's part of blackmail against Palestinian people. Over 2 million people living in Gaza, they are living in the huge jail. The social and economic situation so deteriorated.
For 15 years, the Israeli regime has kept an illegal and inhumane closure on the Gaza Strip, affecting the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians and restricting their freedom of movement.
Gaza crisis. Due to the Israeli continuous blockade for 15 years, suffering from serious implications on the economy, on the humanitarian conditions, the employment, food insecurity, poverty increased to unprecedented percentages.
Tel Aviv's move to shut down the crossings will further complicate living conditions in the impoverished territory.
According to human rights groups, the Israeli blockade has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and worsened its humanitarian conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Turkey says three ships carrying grain will leave Ukraine's ports on Friday under a recent UN-backed deal between Moscow and Kiev. Turkey's defense minister, Hulusi Akar, made the announcement after the first ship filled with Ukrainian grain passed Istanbul on its way to Lebanon. The ship carrying 26,000 tons of maize set off from Odessa on Monday for the Lebanese port of Tripoli. Ukraine said earlier this week that it has 16 more ships loaded with grain and ready to set sail. Last month, Moscow and Kiev agreed in Istanbul to resume shipments of wheat and other grain from Ukraine for the first time since the war started in February. Russia and Ukraine are major grain suppliers. After grain deliveries from Ukraine stopped, global food prices soared, making grain imports too expensive for some of the world's poorest nations. China has launched its largest ever military exercises around Taiwan after a visit to the self-ruled island by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The maneuvers feature live fire sea and air drills in multiple areas around Taiwan. The drills are taking place at some points as close as 20 kilometers from the island. The exercises kicked off on Tuesday and are slated to conclude next Sunday. The drills have drawn a strong reaction from Taiwan. It said China fired multiple ballistic missiles into waters around Taiwan, condemning what it described as irrational actions that undermine peace. Taiwan also said it will, quote, uphold the principle of preparing for war without seeking war.
Tensions are ratcheting up between the United States and China over U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Pelosi arrived in Taiwan late on Tuesday, despite harsh warnings from China. Pelosi is known for her anti-China stance and is the highest elected U.S. official to visit the island since 1997. China is now furious over the visit and has warned of a harsh response.
Well, first of all, both countries, the United States and China, cannot afford to have a hot war now because November is coming up. In the United States, it's the midterm elections. Both Nancy Pelosi and Biden risk seeing their support slipping away. As for China, November is also coming up, signaling the National People's Congress, which is supposed to confirm the presidency's third term, as well as unveiling a new leadership lineup of the top six or seven leaders of the Standing Committee of the Politburo.
China has now threatened to carry out, quote, targeted military operations in response to the visit. The situation around Chinese Taipei is already tense. China has deployed military hardware there and is conducting massive large-scale drills. The exercises feature J-20 stealth fighter jets and test firing of conventional missiles. Chinese military officials say the military exercises are a, quote, a stern deterrence against the United States over Taiwan and a serious warning for supporters of Taiwan independence. This is while some believe the goal of these exercises is to prepare for the military fight with Taiwan. But some believe the visit has in fact put China in the difficult position of having to show a resolute response while avoiding a full-blown conflict.
China's military exercises have been planned in advance. So there is a live fire military exercises now going on quite near Taiwan, less than 100 miles. And then six zones, military exercise zones, have been identified surrounding the Taiwan island, and with live fire military exercises in all the six regions, in effect blockading the Taiwan island for 3 days, just to show, just to teach Taiwan a lesson and to clear, send a clear signal that China's red line has truly been crossed.
The U.S. House Speaker's visit to Chinese Taipei has been met with opposition. It has also been censured both inside and outside Chinese Taipei. Iran's foreign minister has said the trip was a turning point in ties between the United States and China. Russia has backed China and said this visit set China and the U.S. on a collision course.
Pelosi's visit to Taiwan has been condemned by China's allies, including Iran and Russia. Moscow says Russia backs China over the Taiwan issue, warning that the provocative trip would put the United States on a collision course with Beijing. Iran says the visit to Taiwan is a turning point in the already tense ties between China and the U.S. and will have reverberations across the world. Iran has also expressed full support for the One China policy. The crisis dates back to the time when the People's Republic of China was created in 1949. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the U.S. refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Back then, the U.S. decided to open its embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to normalize their ties. In 1979, the U.S. formally recognized the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. This meant that the United States recognized the People's Republic of China as the only legal government of China. But following that, the U.S. Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which has underpinned the U.S. policy towards Taiwan ever since. The act authorizes de facto diplomatic relations and allows the U.S. government to provide weapons to Taiwan.
The unification of Taiwan is very high up on Beijing's agenda. In fact, President Xi Jinping has made it quite plain that the latest time frame for Taiwan unification is the 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. But the ideal solution is still peaceful unification. But peaceful unification comes up with the reality that most of the Taiwanese people do not want a unification. But neither do they want independence, because independence would affect their livelihood or threaten their security. All they want is to maintain the status quo forever. But again, this risks that Taiwan will be drifting further and further away from China. So I think that China is likely to adopt a policy in the same way as they China succeeded now in having Hong Kong being united with the motherland.
The U.S. is now the largest arms provider to Taiwan. The Taiwan crisis comes amid shifting geopolitical alliance. The Ukraine crisis has already weakened the hegemonic position of the United States and its allies. It now appears that Washington is trying to provoke another crisis in the East Asia region to reassert its hegemony.
Moving on, four U.S. police officers have been charged for their role in the killing of a 26-year-old black woman in March 2020. Breonna Taylor was fatally shot during a botched police raid on her apartment in Louisville, Kentucky. During the raid, police officers, who had obtained a controversial no-knock warrant, fired more than 30 shots, mortally wounding Taylor. The officers face federal charges of civil rights offenses, unlawful conspiracy, making false statements, unconstitutional use of force, and obstruction. Obstruction carries a maximum sentence of 20 years, while conspiracy and making false statements are punishable by up to 5 years in prison. They're also accused of violating Taylor's rights by seeking a warrant to search her home when they knew they lacked probable cause. The deaths of Taylor and George Floyd, who was murdered by a white police officer in Minneapolis,
led to massive protests in the U.S. and beyond against racial injustice and police brutality. From the bottom to the very top in France, President Emmanuel Macron's second term is already marked by pessimism amid troubles. Just 100 days after his re-election, the once vivacious president is being described as disinterested and doubtful. Romy Mazoeri reports from Paris.
French President Emmanuel Macron has reached the 100-day mark of his second term, and the contrast with the bold newcomer of 2017 couldn't be more different. Macron is being described as distant, burnt out, weary, and hesitant, but the adjective he may like the least is powerless. 2 months into his new mandate, Macron experienced his worst failure as a politician. His young political party failed to win a parliamentary majority. A president used to ignoring the legislative branch so far hasn't shown much political skill or interest in the tough work of cobbling together successful majorities to get his policies approved. Many believe Macron may call for new elections as early as this year or rule even more often by executive decree. Both options are sure to create major opposition in a new parliament as well as social unrest.
Since the legislative elections, France is in a new political era dominated by uncertainty. Macron has been acting as if he can easily find a majority in parliament on a bill-by-bill basis, but I think that has very little chance to work. It's very likely that in less than a year he'll dissolve parliament and call for new legislative elections.
Polls show that, unlike most winners of presidential elections, Macron has not benefited from the usual honeymoon or grace period. Just like in 2017, Macron was mainly elected to block the far right, but he's no longer a political unknown without a track record. Instead, he's a polarizing figure who has been tarnished worldwide by his authoritarian repression of the Yellow Vest protest movement, and who is perceived domestically as wanting very different things than the average person. Economic stagnation is already upon the Eurozone, and depression could be next. Political stagnation appears to have taken root in France, with perhaps even a depressed president. 100 days into Macron's second term, it's a summer of silent discontent in France, with possibly explosive autumn unrest looming. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, "Perform pilgrimage to Karbala, and don't stop doing this, for Karbala has embraced the best son of the prophets."
In the limelight.
The United States no longer teaches geography or foreign history in its schools, has ever fewer foreign correspondents, glorifies war, and seems to view diplomacy as nothing more than foreplay before a military assault, says Chas W. Freeman, writer, in an article published under the heading U.S. Interests and Pretenses in a Changing West Asia. Stay tuned for more. Domestic political calculations, not the strategic pursuit of national interest, have just led Biden to affirm his fidelity to Zionism with a trip to the occupied Palestinian territories, called Israel, the only regime in the world where Donald Trump is more popular than he is. From the occupied Palestinian territories, the president traveled to Saudi Arabia, hat and emergency gas can in hand, to dine on symbolic crow as a guest of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, whom, to much domestic American applause, he had loudly denounced and pledged to make a pariah. But no one should be surprised that he didn't condemn the Saudi regime for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Neither he nor any other president has ever held the Zionist regime accountable for murdering Americans like Shirin Abu Aghila, Rachel Corrie, or the crew of the USS Liberty. Get real. Why should Biden be more concerned about a dead citizen of Saudi Arabia than about dead Americans? In Jeddah, the president bombed fist with MBS and made the Zionist regime's case for a normalized relationship with its Arab neighbors, despite its continuing cruelty to the Palestinian Arabs it oppresses. It doesn't get more demeaning than this. When interests and pretenses collide, interests prevail. When foreign and domestic interests are in conflict, domestic interests come first. Nothing unusual about that. Let's hear it for AIPAC and cheap gas. If it's obvious why Biden needed the Zionist regime in Saudi Arabia at this moment, it's less clear why they needed him. America has lost its grip on the West Asia region, which is now not its or any other great power's fiefdom. Diminished leverage in the region makes Washington a less compelling partner than it once was. The United States no longer attempts to achieve peace for the Palestinians. Regardless of doubts about Washington's reliability as a protector, the Zionist regime, the Arab participants in the eruption of realpolitik known as the Abraham Accords in Saudi Arabia, all recognize that they have no real alternative to a U.S. security umbrella. No other great power is able to assume or indeed has any desire to take up American defense burdens in the region. But what's in it for Americans to soldier on? There are, in fact, serious matters at stake for the U.S. in West Asia beyond the sole reason the president gave to exclude Chinese and Russian influence there. Washington has set aside reliance on diplomatic persuasion in favor of coercive policies based on dollar sovereignty. The U.S. now imposes sanctions on any and all countries that defy its policies. This practice and the lawless confiscation of a growing number of countries' dollar reserves have put America at odds with much of the world. The dollar ceased to be convertible to gold in 1971. Since then, its centrality to global trade settlement and finance has been sustained by a Saudi commitment, which OPEC grudgingly follows, to price energy in dollars. Should the Saudis decide to accept other currencies for their oil, markets for other commodities would do the same. This would collapse the dollar and the exorbitant privilege it affords the United States and terminate U.S. global primacy. And and this is not a small matter. To get from Asia to Europe or vice versa, you need permission to transit Saudi airspace. So, U.S. global strategic mobility is hostage to the kingdom's goodwill. The geopolitical cost of an unfriendly and uncooperative relationship with Riyadh would be immense. Saudi Arabia is the largest single foreign purchaser of both American and British defense equipment and services. Many production lines in the US and UK would shut down if the kingdom bought elsewhere. Lots of jobs would be lost. The US relationship with Saudi Arabia is, of course, not the only challenge to US strategic interests in the region. U.S. forces have illegally invaded Syria and are engaged there in dangerous maneuvers against Syrian forces. These confrontations risk wider wars, and not just in the region. The post-Saddam order disassembled battalions of the bloc unilaterally imposed on Iraq earlier this century is unstable and crumbling. Iraq's future alignments are in doubt. The Biden administration does not appear to have an answer to this. Egypt, the fake regime of Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the UAE, among others, are attempting to dilute their strategic overdependence on the U.S. They do not share Washington's global obsessions, are alarmed by its erratic politics, resent its efforts to coerce them into placing dubious U.S. interests above their own, and will not downgrade relations with China and Russia to please America. The Zionist regime continues to terrorize and dispossess its captive Arab populations and to violate the sovereignty of neighboring states. The Zionist regime is increasingly dismissive of U.S. advice to restrain its violent behavior. It appears to believe that it has a blank check from America. Maybe it does. Others in the region want the U.S. to make them safe from the Zionist regime, not the Zionist regime safe from them. It's a truism that failure provides more lessons than success. But the U.S. no longer teaches geography or foreign history in its schools, has ever fewer foreign correspondents, glorifies war, and seems to view diplomacy as nothing more than foreplay before a military assault.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, my very dear sisters. Welcome to Muslim Lady. The month of Muharram is already there, so I offer my condolences to every single one of you, and of course Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, in order to broaden your insight. So today, since it is Muharram, we are going to have some discussion upon the women who participated in this story that created Muharram, actually. This is Asma, your humble host, and here with me I have my very dear sister, Sister Sadiqa. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to Muslim Lady.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Of course, same in here. Okay, dear ladies, today we are going to talk about the role of women in the battlefield of Karbala and in the journey of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in his way to teach us the truth of Islam that has been so much deviated from its true path. And also, we are going to look at the very comparison between the mother and the daughter and what they shared and contributed to the improvement, or just let's say to help the imam of their time. So, sister, let's start with the role of Lady Zainab in the journey of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So, in the previous session, we talked a lot about the fact that women were carried with Imam in order to be the witness of this incident, of this great event that happened in the history of Islam, and also in order for them to be the narrator of this history. And then we got to the point that Lady Zainab in Damascus, she had some lectures and sermons that affected many people and enlightened them as well, and actually led to the downfall of Bani Umayyah. Now, shall we just continue on that point?
So Lady Zainab, as we know, is the daughter of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima, and she's also the sister of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. So Lady Zainab alayhi salam, from a very young age, she saw what her mother Hazrat Fatima had to do to protect the wilayah of Imam Ali alayhi salam,
or
in other terms, the imamat of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So according to history, there was an oath of allegiance that was taken on the day of Ghadir. But then as soon as the Prophet died, there were a few individuals who took the caliphate and they denied Imam Ali alayhi salam the caliphate.
Yeah.
So Hazrat Fatima alayhi salam, in that instance, she drew on all the political situation of the time, and she goes into the court of the caliph at that time, which was the masjid, which was the mosque.
Yeah.
Right? The mosque of the Prophet was a place where all the important matters used to take place. Now, according to one of the authors, I believe his name is Shahid Baqir al-Sadr, he's written a very interesting book looking into this specific event.
Who actually was an Islamic scholar.
He's an Islamic scholar, and he's not Shaheed because he was killed in a very brutal manner because of his Islamic views.
Yeah.
And he was killed by Saddam Hussein, I believe.
Yes, and he was a very important figure.
Very important figure who's written many, many great books that are still studied. So when he looks at this event, he says Hazrat Fatima walked, her house was actually connected to the mosque.
Yeah.
Her door was open into the mosque.
The Prophet made it that way.
Yes, according to the verse of the Quran.
Yes, according
But what she does is that day, she doesn't go from her house into the mosque. She takes another route. She walks out from the other door into the main road and then enters from another mosque to collect attention of the people. She doesn't go alone. She goes with a group of women who protect her.
Okay, dear audience, welcome back to Muslim Lady. We're talking about the whole story of Karbala and the role of women in participating in this battlefield.
She goes into the court in front of the caliph and delivers a whole sermon. And it's a very long sermon. It's
a great message, actually.
Exactly. It's a very long sermon that looks at the different Islamic principles. But when we come to the crux of it, she draws on the political time. She talks to them about how her husband had been chosen and what different services he had given to Islam, because these people had drawn on the caliphate on the basis that they had migrated with the Prophet. Therefore, they were very close to the Prophet. Therefore, they deserved to be Prophet.
Yeah.
Therefore, they deserved to have caliphate. So drawing on that same argument of theirs, she says, well, my husband has more virtues, right? Mm-hmm. Now, apart from this sermon only, she had other roles as well in advancing the imamat of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes.
So we know that in the night for 40 days...
And actually in shedding light on the truth.
Exactly. So we know that, according to history, we know that up to 40 days she went to the houses of the companions with her husband and her two sons and asked them, did you not give the oath of allegiance on the day of Ghadir? Why have you turned back? And these people, like we mentioned, the people of Kufa, there's a similarity. They deny it. They say, if you would have come to us before the other caliph, we would have given you the oath of allegiance, yes, but we've already given it to someone else. So they're turning back on the oath of allegiance. Now we compare it to Kufa. They write letters to Imam Hussein, and then they turn back and say, but we didn't write any letters to you. What are you saying?
Yeah.
Right? So understanding the political circumstance was so important. You see, women are often understood as people who have to have household chores, take care of children. Yes, please do take care of your child. The child needs to be nurtured by you. But don't forget that you need to understand, because when it comes to the imam, there is no man and woman.
Exactly, yes.
You have an equal role in defending the imam. You might not need to go to the battlefield, but if it comes to supporting him with your tongue and your work, you have to do it.
And maybe they could even enlighten their husbands.
Exactly. And this is what Hazrat Fatima did. This was a very good point you mentioned. When she was on her deathbed, the women of Medina come to her and she delivers another sermon to them, explaining to them that what their husbands have done is wrong. It's a very nice sermon. Everything is available. There's actually a book that's been translated into English, Lady Fatima from Cradle to Grave, available in English. It's been translated by Sheikh Tahir Ridha Jafar as well. So if anyone wants to Google it, it's available in PDF. I have checked it as well. And it has all these sermons inside it.
Thank you for sharing that.
So she talks to these women. Now, these women were not aware of the political circumstances. Mm-hmm. So when they hear the sermon of Hazrat Fatima, they go back and they beat their husbands up over it. Why did you leave the daughter of the Prophet?
Yeah.
So the role of the woman here. Now let's go to Karbala.
Exactly.
Hazrat Zainab, she's seen everything, right? She's seen how her mother has been able. So there's a book that's written by...
Now, as the mother is the daughter.
The daughter. She continues what her mother started in defending imamate.
Yeah, and she finishes that.
She finishes it. Now there's a book written by Anita Rai.
Yeah.
She's an author. She's written many novels, but towards the last few years that I have been following her, she's written a lot of historical books about the life of the Prophet. But there is one book that she has written, The Essential Woman, that compares Hazrat Zainab and Hazrat Fatima.
Mm-hmm.
And here she tries to compare the role of these two great women and how they complement each other, and how the daughter took on a lot from the mother in defending imamate. Like when Hazrat Fatima was in the mosque defending the imamate of Imam Ali alayhi salam, she proves to them, and in the other historical instances, we're like going to the houses of the companions and asking them why they withdrew the oath of allegiance from Imam Ali alayhi salam, thus invalidating the caliphate that had taken seat.
Yeah.
Hazrat Zainab goes into the court of Yazid and she refers to him as Tulaqa. And she tells them, Antum Tulaqa, you are those people who were freed by my grandfather and you have no right to his seat in caliphate.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
If we go back to history, when the conquest of Mecca happened, those who did not accept Islam up till that day, they were, in other terms, freed by the Prophet. They were told that their blood will not be shed. They're free to live by the Muslims.
Yeah.
They accepted Islam because the Prophet was the Caliph at the time. He did have governorship over that time. It was agreed that these people who were freed on the day of the conquest of Mecca would not be allowed to take caliphate ever. One of those who was freed was Muawiyah, the father of Yazid.
Yeah.
Muawiyah still did go on to take on caliphate, but Yazid did go as
and
well.
And she makes that clear for
she
people.
She makes it very clear for the people over there that you have no right, Yazid, you have no right to take the seat because you are those people who are freed by my grandfather.
Yeah.
And by the law that we had established and everyone had agreed to, your caliphate is invalid. Mm-hmm. Based on what has happened in the past, because you exactly. people are the ones who fought against the Muslims while you're now residing over the Muslims. Mm-hmm. How does that make sense?
So now we can see that as a woman, she becomes the leader of this journey.
Exactly.
She starts to lead everyone, to be the one who brings enlightenment to people's head.
Yes. Then when we see how Hazrat Fatima defended Imam Ali alayhi salam, we know that the door was struck on her. We know that she was whipped when she was holding onto his cloth when they were trying to drag him away. Now we go to Karbala. Imam Hussein is in his last breaths. He's in the state of sajda. Shimar is there. He's going to kill him. Hazrat Zainab runs out of her tent. And she addresses one of the army leaders. I believe his name was Ubaydullah. And he actually did not want to come to the war. Yeah. He had tried ways to find, but it was his love for wealth and his love for leadership that brought him there. And she tells him, are you going to stand there while the son of the Prophet is being killed?
That's very sorrowful.
And she goes over there and she tries to protect him. And they whip her before Imam Hussein realizes, because, you know, he's in his last breath. He has not had water. He's very... According to some, he's moving in and out of consciousness, according to some. In that, she goes to try and defend him. And when he regains consciousness, he tells us to go back. So Hazrat Fatima in Medina was defending Imam Ali. Hazrat Zainab seen the role of her mother in Medina.
Yeah.
And she assumes the same role when it goes to defending the Imam of her time. And we see throughout her journey from Karbala to Damascus and back to Medina, she was defending the next Imam. And mm-hmm. inshallah, that can be discussed at a later.
Yeah, and also we saw that the role of a mother in Islamic heritage is that she would nurture kids like her.
Exactly.
So that they would lead the entire journey.
And this is what Hazrat Fatima did perfectly
exactly.
well.
Exactly, yeah. Thank you, sister. We used all the information you shared with us. Thank you for that. And thank you for mentioning the name of the books. And thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return. La ilaha
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He's the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the US, a hefty financial verdict this week could dissuade politically driven liars. But the path forward is uncertain and the legal battles take a toll. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalist Elizabeth Williamson. The piece is titled, Lies for Profit: Can Sandy Hook Parents Shut Alex Jones Down? When viral lies harm private people, are the courts of law their best refuge? A trial to decide how much the conspiracy broadcaster Alex Jones must pay a Sandy Hook family for defaming them attempts to answer that question. Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis, the parents of Jesse Lewis, a 6-year-old who died at Sandy Hook, are requesting $150 million in compensatory damages for years of torment and threats that they endured in the aftermath of Alex Jones's lies about them on InfoWars, his Austin-based website and broadcast. They are suing him in the first of three trials in which juries will decide how much he must pay relatives of 10 people killed in the 14th of December 2012 mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, for spreading lies that they were actors in a false flag operation planned by the government as a pretext for gun control. Last year, Alex Jones lost a series of Sandy Hook defamation cases by default, setting the stage for the damages trials. Neil Heslin, Scarlett Lewis, and J.T. Lewis, Jesse Lewis's brother, will testify this week. More important than money, the parents said, is society's verdict on a culture in which viral misinformation damages lives and destroys reputations, yet those who spread it are seldom held accountable. Speech is free, but lies you have to pay for, Mark Bankston, the parents' lawyer, told the jury in his opening statement last week. This is a case about creating change. But the trial demonstrates how difficult it is to counter the views of diehard conspiracy theorists. Over nearly 3 days of testimony last week, Daria Karpova, InfoWars corporate representative, advanced bogus claims, refusing even to rule out the possibility that the trial itself was a staged event. She cast Alex Jones as the victim, worrying over his health and saying the Sandy Hook lawsuits have cost him millions. That claim allowed the family's lawyers to share records with the jury showing that InfoWars reaped revenues of more than $50 million annually in recent years. We'll be right back. At the heart of the trial is a June 2017 episode of NBC's Sunday Night with Megyn Kelly, in which Miss Kelly profiled Alex Jones. In the broadcast, Neil Heslin protested Alex Jones's denial of the shooting. He recalled his last moments with his son Jesse, saying, "I held my son with a bullet hole through his head." Afterward, Alex Jones and Owen Schroyer, a lieutenant of Mr. Jones at InfoWars, aired shows implying that Neil Heslin had lied. "Will there be a clarification from Heslin or Megyn Kelly?" Owen Schroyer said on InfoWars. "I wouldn't hold your breath." Lawyers say the three trials hold lessons for other cases against conspiracy-minded defendants, from the January 6th insurrectionists to Trump allies sued for falsely claiming that voting machine manufacturers helped steal the 2020 presidential election. Alex Jones is also under scrutiny for his role in events surrounding the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. These Sandy Hook parents have spent years of their lives and sacrificed whatever is left of their privacy to shine a light on peddlers of disinformation, not only to seek justice for their children, but to make folks who profit from tragedy consider the consequences of their actions, said Karen Burgess, a trial lawyer at Burgess Law in Austin, Texas, who represented Dominion Voting Systems when it was sued by Texas conspiracy theorists who said the company helped rig the 2020 vote. Facing sanctions from the court, the conspiracy theorists dropped their lawsuit against the company. Lawyers for the Sandy Hook families say a verdict expected this week in the first trial could send a signal to other conspiracy purveyors about the cost of online lies and set into motion a chain of events that could shut InfoWars down. Still, the path forward is not clear. On Friday, 29th of July, Alex Jones put InfoWars parent company Free Speech Systems into Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which usually automatically halts all pending litigation. Free Speech Systems, however, requested that the bankruptcy court lift that automatic stay so the trial in progress can continue to a verdict. That motion is set for a hearing on Monday morning in a bankruptcy court in Victoria, Texas. Judge Maya Guerra Gamble of the Travis County District Court indicated that the trial would proceed. Lawyers for the family say a big jury award this week, along with the bankruptcy, could threaten InfoWars' operations. But many details about Mr. Jones's current finances are murky. For now, the filing puts on hold the remaining two Sandy Hook damages trials, both scheduled for this September. In court last week, Alex Jones's lawyers launched a defense advanced by other defendants in politically charged defamation cases. "Our national discourse has become so polluted by disinformation," they said, "that who really knows what is true or false?" Federico Andio Reynal, Alex Jones's lawyer, blamed errors in mainstream media reports about Sandy Hook for the bogus theories spread by Mr. Jones. He had seen what he perceived as so many lies and so many cover-ups and so much hand-washing of the facts that he had become biased, Mr. Reynal said. He was looking at the world through dirty glasses, and if you look at the world through dirty glasses, everything you see is dirty. But InfoWars staffers testified that they did not check easily available facts about Sandy Hook or much else before broadcasting their incendiary assertions. Lawyers for Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis, using internal emails and testimony from InfoWars staffers, showed how Alex Jones and his top lieutenants ignored multiple warnings and continued to broadcast Sandy Hook lies would harm the survivors and land InfoWars in legal trouble. In a videotaped deposition, a former employee, Rob Jacobson, said he repeatedly delivered these warnings to InfoWars staffers, only to be received with laughter and jokes. The NBC episode, which was shown in the court of law, was particularly striking. In it, Alex Jones made a variety of damaging false claims, including dismissing a 2017 suicide bombing that killed 22 adults and children at an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England, as an attack on a bunch of liberal trendies. Owen Schroyer also testified that he failed to fact-check a false report on the episode defaming Neil Heslin because he did not have the time. At the trial last week, Alex Jones's seat at the defense table often remained empty. His lawyer, Mr. Reynal, has declined to say whether he will testify, adding that Mr. Jones is in charge of his defense. Mr. Reynal told the judge that Alex Jones's absence were because of a medical condition that Alex Jones, speaking outside of the courthouse, described as an untreated hernia. But he continues to broadcast his show where he and Mr. Schroyer derided the trial last week, violating the judge's order not to comment on it. When Alex Jones did come to court, he drove up in a motorcade and sat in the courtroom surrounded by bodyguards. Last week, Mr. Reynal thrust a raised middle finger into the face of the family's lawyer in a dispute over exhibits that nearly ended in a fistfight. The trial proceedings have taken a toll on Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis. They hired security after they spotted people waiting for them outside of their hotel, and they have heard InfoWars loyalists describe them as pawns in Alex Jones's pursuit of online clout. During his testimony in court on Thursday, Owen Schroyer suggested that it was the lawsuits, not his and Alex Jones's lies, that exacerbated the family's suffering. "I'm very upset that this continues," he said, citing its tremendous negative effects on my career and my livelihood.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.